Hello and welcome to episode 15 of Chips of Chorlton. I am joined by Robin.
Hi.
Andy.
Hello.
And Duncan.
I'm really cold.
You're really cold. Yeah. We're in a new setting, aren't we?
Yeah. It's fucking freezing.
Is it really that bad?
Yeah.
It's mid-June.
Yeah, it's mid-June. I've got three layers on. Still cold.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, yeah. So sorry we haven't been around.
Can I just say, is it episode 15, including the one that we did put out from the other month? Because you went and had a baby, didn't you?
I went and had a baby. I think I had a semi-breakdown and then a baby.
Okay.
So I just...
You're all right now?
I couldn't be arsed editing the podcast. When I went to editor, I was like, oh my God, what do I do? And I just went to bed instead.
Okay, I think that's a fairly
good reason. Oh yeah, because there was another episode we did, wasn't
there? Yeah,
yeah. We couldn't really be...
Is this another one on top of the other one that we didn't release?
Yeah, so we've now got two in the Patreon.
They were both shit.
Which, I don't know, I thought the second one was all right.
The last one was a sober one, wasn't it? The last one we did.
Don't make it out like we have a problem.
Yeah, so we're in... I don't know, I have this kind of weird outhouse at the back of my garden.
Outhouse?
Yeah, granny flat.
My wife, who we're obviously with new child, has kicked us out of my kitchen.
With good cause.
Took absolutely fair enough and put us in my music room.
Looking out of the outhouse now, I've only just realised that where we usually do the podcast is directly below your son's room, who's usually obviously asleep or trying to get to sleep.
Yes, yeah.
We slept. I imagine Mike Joyce's cackles have made it into his nightmares.
Oh, believe me.
That was a great night.
Yeah, yeah, it was a great night.
joyous cackles.
It's kind of... Yeah. The irony of that night is that I was pretty much forced to sleep in this room after that podcast. because I was in the doghouse, you know.
Yeah.
So what you all been up to in the 2 months fell off, you know?
Has it been 2 months?
I think it was. Yeah, I think it's approximately 2 months. Yeah, yeah. So I suppose I've been off work a month with the new baby. So yeah. So what you all been up to, Robin?
Yeah, been quite busy. Yeah, I've got going to Japan on Friday.
Going to Japan.
I mean, as this airs, I am in Japan.
Wow. Whereabouts?
So we're going to Tokyo, and then we're traveling up to Otsuchi. So basically, I'm going out there with visual artist Clara Cassian, who I collaborated on for the Birdsong Stories from Pripyat project a few years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Pripyat.
Just bring in light relief, mate.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's pretty serious.
It's all kind of come full circle now that Chernobyl's...
Yeah, that's about to say.
That's how you do a Chernobyl film,
really,
mate.
Kind of, you should really sort of... I mean, I know you were pushing it for a while, but now's the time to push it again.
Well, I would have thought, you know, we brought that film out on the 30th anniversary. It feels like HBO are a bit late, really.
Yeah, it does, yeah. Yeah, you bob on, yeah.
Anyway.
that is the now rated best TV show of all time on IMDb.
Yeah, but I mean, Birdsong Stories from Pripyat isn't on IMDb, so...
Yeah, exactly.
You'll never know, I guess.
So not to give much of your content away, is it more about the nuclear bomb?
It's more about the after effects of the tsunami. And
right, okay.
But again, yeah, we're putting together an art film and I'm putting the soundtrack together. So very much early stages, but yeah, we're going away for 12 days to film and research and get everything together. So
good. So when are we expecting to go and see it? When can we all go?
I reckon it'll be early next year.
Brilliant.
That's the plan.
You're going to do Manchester and elsewhere, or what's...
Yeah, definitely Manchester, definitely London, and probably two or three other places in the UK. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I did a thing.
Go on.
I've done a thing, sort of. I got asked to be part of a thing, and I was a bit like, that's something I would really want to see anyway, so I'll say yes to it. But you may or may not have heard about the Slow Club documentary film that they've got coming out called Our Most Brilliant Friends, which basically is sort of an MTV tour diary. Well, not MTV tour diary, it's just a tour diary of just compartmentalizing it for that generation. That was a thing. It was a good show. It wasn't a bad show. It's essentially a tour diary of Slow Club's 2016 winter tour, supporting the fourth album. I forget the title of it now. And basically... I was asked to compare a Q&A for it after kind of like a special screening of it on Monday, just gone. And it was a really interesting experience to do because, of course, basically our band and their band, we've kind of come through during the same times. We've experienced the same hardships within the industry. We've experienced the same I'm going to call it sociopolitical vacuums of songwriting, where kind of, you know, when you look at how bands direct themselves and project themselves and shape themselves, a lot of it does come down to that. But anyway, this and that and the other. Like, you know, we've had similar experiences that they've had, and it's them going around the toilet circuit. It's all the venues that we've done as well. And it's just like, the opening scene of them on tour is them doing an XFM session at Leicester Square. You remember that studio? Yeah.
Done that several times.
Sent shivers down the spine. Yeah. Really, just seeing those doors open up again, I was like, oh. Like, there is nothing... Nothing will make you feel more dejected in this industry than standing around Leicester Square with all your flight cases racked up, with just every regular Joe Shitmuncher walking past you as if they're used to the sight of you every day. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, of course.
It's just really weird. And they're there on the same day that Phil Collins is there. So you can hear Rebecca going, there's a lot of autograph hunters out there today. What's going on? It's like, oh yeah, Phil Collins is in apparently. It's like, oh right. And then just the silence afterwards, all these things are just tinged. There's a tinge of sadness to it all.
Yeah.
Anyway, we did this Q&A, and I asked the director, Piers, like, how did you pitch this? He didn't really give me an answer about that in the end. Like, really nice guy. It's a really good film. But yeah, so I don't know how they managed to pitch recording this whole thing, but essentially what they've done is they've recorded their last tour together, and I think essentially they break up on that tour, and it's incredibly insightful as well as profound in its kind of, in its amicable sadness, really, about, you know, as a musician and as someone who cares about other musicians' projects, like, you know, as fan and musician, it works on two levels, really, and it's great. And so when that comes out, I implore people to see it immediately. It's a very good film.
So when's that out? Do you know, have an idea?
I don't actually know.
Okay, no problem.
Well, no, but
coming to a cinema near you soon.
I don't know when
soon.
It's out. And and I know that and doing the Q&A was a really interesting sort of experience, mainly to do, like, I apologise to people of Manchester who've probably seen me with a microphone now far too many times. in other ways, like, oh my God, it's him again. But at the same time, I think it's really interesting to see how what Piers and Rebecca, who were there for the Q&A, what they weren't quite prepared for was the fact that they were going to have to explain it. And it's a really hard thing to explain. It was a bit like explaining why Sped wasn't with us when we did the in-store tour before Oh Shudder. Like, the first time you explain that, you're explaining about how two sides have failed a friendship.
Yeah, it's a personal thing, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. And hopefully by the time I explain that to Rebecca beforehand, I'll be like, it's a bit like this, isn't it? And but by the sixth gig, we were just like, oh yeah, he's gone. Statement present.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you do get used to it, but I can just see that they weren't quite prepared for what this part of their legacy is now. But it's really interesting, and it's fantastic.
Okay. Yeah. Hopefully we can get Rebecca on close to the time. The
release
that'll be amazing.
I told her we do a podcast about Chips, and she is all in.
Good.
Happy days.
Good, good. Andy.
So if you're listening, thanks.
Andy, what have you been doing?
I don't really have anything more exciting to add.
You guys had a tune on Channel 4, didn't you? Not to...
Yeah.
Are we allowed to talk about that?
Of course, yeah. But it's a bit corporate, isn't it?
It's sort of your commercial day job that you have.
Written some Arctic Monkeys soundalikes, and then one of them appeared on...
The song's nothing like Arctic Monkeys, though, just in case anyone's listening. Yeah.
Arctic Monkey-inspired pieces.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, but it was on a telly show, which was nice, but
whilst you were watching it, that was the thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was nice.
Lovely.
Yeah. But yeah, other than that, no, nothing.
Nothing
I
going
went,
down.
Went to the pub, went to Duffy's for a bit.
Yeah, it's good.
Watching the Women's World Cup. Watched Chernobyl, which is brilliant. Are we doing that? Are we doing what you've been watching on telly?
You've been listening to the national record as well, you've been saying. Yeah.
Because we're all going to, well, hopefully all of us are going to the national gig. And I've had some... Not everyone seems to have varied opinions on the national. You either like them or you don't. But I've not really been that sort of impressed.
Remember, you were really into them.
I loved Alligator.
Yeah,
I loved it. You know, I think, but they were relatively unknown before Boxer. But
yeah.
I don't know why the album struck a chord with me. But then I like Boxer as well. But then since then, nothing's really struck me until this album on first impressions. Like, it just feels a little bit more varied, like it's sort of stylistically. And I think that's the way of big acts these days, especially pop acts. It's more about trying to vary the genre and trying to make an album interesting track to track. They're often longer as well, because they've experimented with different genres. And I think it's good that people that bands can go that way as well, and not just sort of established pop acts. Like, if you listen to a a Katy Perry album or whatever, that there's so many different genres on there that, you know, all based around basically the same chords and the same hooks and the same sort of aesthetic. But it's cool when bands do that. I like just, you know, different styles, different textures, instrumentation. It's just, and then it just hit me a little bit more, this one.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose I'm a huge Nashville fan. And I picked them up around the Boxer era, if you like. And they've built their own studio. I don't know where it is in the world, but you can tell that they have the time and they're so relaxed with the writing process on the, you can really get a sense of that on this record for me, that they've probably just spent 2 years together and they're very comfortable each other's presence, obviously very, you know, very happy with each other. And, you know, I think the studio's on a lake and they all go swimming and it just sounds really idyllic. And they've, I was reading into sort of track by track. There's a lot of female vocalists on this record. I can't remember which track it was, but they just went through like 7 or 8 different female vocalists until they got the right kind of vibe for the voice. And I think, God, to be in that position must be unreal, you know.
We always used to have like one track on each album where I'd get told we have to have a female voice on this. What was that about?
Was that, I don't know whether that was label or management or producer, like who was that, who kind of...
don't know what that was about.
But we did it.
Yeah, no, just...
But it never
just
ended
get
up.
Told. I just always get like, you know, somewhere down the production, that's like, right, this song here, female vocal on it.
But it never ended up being like, in the foreground.
It doesn't matter what I think.
No, it's always
gonna
in the background. It was always
completely quashed down, so it was... You couldn't recognise it.
Yeah.
I was like, what was the point in that? I mean, I'm all up for doing it. I think it was Zugzwang. Possibly. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, I'd kind of based like the artists in my mind when we were writing that song. I was like, I was trying to rip off female singers. I think I was trying to rip off Grace Jones for that one. you know, and like, yeah, let's go for it, but let's find the right voice. And there's like, well, is there the right, I mean, then we realized we don't know any female singers in Manchester. Yeah. It was like, oh, all right, okay, well, whatever.
Yeah. I think it's got fit as well. It's got fit the track. I think that's what I learned from reading about the National. There's all good getting someone in.
But the National do it in a way where there's the female is a lead vocal without his voice, because his is a very deep, powerful, overpowering voice. Whereas we've done it as trying to get another texture in there.
Yeah.
And what we should have probably done is, you know, if we thought a verse or a chorus somewhere needed a different lead vocal, you know, do it like that, because otherwise a lot of like a lot of Dutch Uncle's production, a lot of stuff is thrown at it and then gets very buried. It gets very down there, sort of in amongst the earth. That's essentially what happened there, I think.
Yeah, most definitely. And my one issue with the National is that they can still get away with looking so boring. That's my only issue with them. But I really am looking forward to that gig. Again, as you said about Alligator, I have the same thing with Boxer, really. Yeah. I think they are one of those bands that you just like one of their albums or not. I remember trying to give them a scathing review on Six Music's Roundtable once by giving it 5 out of 10. Oh. And I was like, and let me tell you why. And then Tom Robinson just completely just went, yeah, whatever. And hey, no. And then
can't
Isaac
the National
Slade,
off on Six Music.
I know, but I was like, 5 out of 10. It's like, because it's not good and it's not bad. It's just somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Like our second album review.
Yeah. as a middle-aged man, as I am with a child, his lyrically, it just absolutely nails my life. You know what I mean? And I'm really, really happy that there's someone who can actually write lyrics and be in a band at that age and look like that. And I just think that's fucking great.
Well, there's legitimate calls for him to be considered the greatest lyricist of a generation now, isn't there?
I always get kind of overwhelmed and a bit, you know, put him on a pedestal a little bit. I think he should be considered as good a lyricist as Morrissey, in my opinion,
does he address enough of a sort of varied issues and subjects?
Yeah,
I think so. I think if you look at it, so my...
And he's not a fascist as well.
He's not a cunt, is he? So is it? But
actually, yeah, Morrissey's got 20 years on him.
My wife and I decided to have Fake Empire as our first dance at our wedding, and that is a dig at capitalism. I think it's great. I think it's falling in love in New York, but you think, oh, it's just all, you know, all this is bullshit around me. That's great. I think they're absolutely brilliant, and I'm so pleased. I just always expected their success to tail off but it hasn't done. And I'm just like, wow, a band can do essentially middle-aged indie music and make a success of it. You know, and I think that's great. It's inspiring to me.
But you say that's, you know, you're surprised that their success hasn't... They're at the perfect age now to write about that sort of stuff, to write about, you know... Yeah, to be anti-capitalist and to have worries generally around the world. They're at the right age to do that, I think. They're almost at the right age for their sound and that and what's always been their sound. Now is the sort a bit like Elbow as well. Their sound was always probably older than they were, and then that's why their success is sort of you know, not tailed off.
Yeah. But I suppose as a fan of both, my interest in Elbow is tailed off as the albums have come in. You know, I think Asleep in the Back.
But they've remained as popular.
Asleep in the Back, again, putting bands on pedestals, should be regarded as probably. It's probably in my top five albums. One of the best albums that a Manchester band has ever produced is Asleep in the Back. I don't think it gets enough credit because they're so successful now to what they've done in the past. So, yeah.
You mentioned Morrissey.
Go on.
Can we talk about what also happened?
We're still in the What Happened section.
We're still in the What Happened section. Go on.
I forgot what that Morrissey impression even was now. From how many episodes ago? 12?
12 episodes.
12.
Yeah, go on. I ain't explaining it.
Andy, did you pick a fight with someone online?
So, ex-Hacienda DJ Dave Haslam, who's very very good on Twitter, very you know,
prolific.
Yeah, very, you know, lefty sort point. Of anti-fascism, but like in a sort of with a sort of mank aesthetic, like you say, to the point.
In a way that's very reasonable.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
It's not pushing anything else. It's just the facts. Yeah.
Exactly. But I think along with quite a lot of other people, he'd pointed out that Morrissey was wearing a For Britain badge on an American interview. I can't remember which interview in particular.
Have you seen the one he did with Larry King?
No.
It's so embarrassing. It's great.
But then I just, as I've explained before on this podcast, feeling incredibly betrayed by Morrissey's lyrics and what it seemed to be hinting about during his time in the Smiths, I just posted an honest opinion and replied to Dave Haslam on Twitter saying, what a fucking shambles of a man, which I think he really is now. And that's what he's turned into. If he genuinely believes in everything that party stands for, or whether it's just that party has a reasonable animal rights policy, but also their leader is someone described as a Nazi by Nigel Farage. But anyway, so I posted what a fucking shambles of a man, and then a Morrissey impersonator underneath that posted what a shambles of a band.
Yeah. And then this started like a series of tweets.
The gauntlet was thrown.
To be fair, it was probably 70-30 backing us up, but surprised that the 30% of people who were sort of on the Morrissey impersonator side being like, yeah, there's some horrible vitriol about Morrissey out there. Like, you know, if you jump ship now, then you're not a real fan. It's like, there's more important things than following your idols and, you know, being true to their music. And if that's what you think you're doing, if they believe in far right ideologies, it's fine to criticize them, which I think is what he hasn't really got about it, because his arguments were relentless with everyone else, with you, Robin, as well.
Oh, yeah, he blocked me.
Did he block you?
He blocked Robin.
Yeah. Everyone's quick to block you and your parents.
Yeah. Who's that?
He was. But yeah, he was. He just couldn't get it. Like every little, obviously people know what Morrissey believes in now, and or what he seems to believe in, but every little thing, everyone. Would post one, or everyone who's on our side would post sort of one line is about it, like, yeah, but...
I think one of the best ones was that the Morrissey impersonator said about us that only our dying grandmothers like our music.
Oh, no, I was trying to find the tweet that he described, like, oh, shut up, only your ailing, is it ailing grandmothers and long-suffering girlfriends are your fans?
Yeah,
jokes on you, mate, all my grandparents are dead. Fine.
Well, John from Everything commented on it saying, their grandmothers fucking hate them, you idiot.
Yeah. and you know what?
You fucking egg.
If they were alive, they would.
Yeah.
Picking up on sort of right-wing politics and music generally, we wanted to talk this week about, is it Kildren?
Kildren.
Yeah. Kildren.
That's the one.
Yeah, the band that were dropped from Glastonbury over their offensive lyrics to the Conservative Party. Yeah, I just...
How offensive were they again?
They basically said...
The lyrics at the top, aren't they?
Lyrics at the top, is that? Even if it's your dad or your mum, kill Tory scum, kill Tory scum. Is that a little bit too far, lyrically? I'm going to ask this probably to you, Duncan, as the lyricist of Dutch Uncles. What's your thoughts on it?
It certainly doesn't open itself to any double meanings.
No.
That's my first criticism. Always, personal taste aside, it's probably a bit much.
You prefer depends. Some subtleties there, you know.
Would I prefer? Yeah, I prefer subtleties. I mean, unfortunately, whatever. I mean, Danger, it plays right into the Tories' hands, to be fair, so I don't really know. You know, I mean, it's not constructive. Like, is the, you know, for what they're saying, it's just not constructive. And unfortunately for them, unfortunately for them, because they played right into the game, because someone at a newspaper has found out about them, just gone, do you know they have this song? Kind of thing. Whereas no one would have cared to have gone to see Kildren, except for the people that already know who Kildren are and are already prepared to hear that song and know what it is and aren't going to act on it or whatever. You know, like, so basically, they've given them 5 minutes of fame on this, and they've paid the price by not being able to play Glastonbury. It'll do the band no wonders of good, for people, for exposure. But at the same time, it doesn't progress the action that's needed in order to make political songwriting actually efficient or actually work in any respect, does it? It doesn't do that, so. It's a bit of a mess, really. But then again, like, the stage has been a bit of a mess ever since Fat White Family shit on it. So, I mean that literally.
Fat White Family were another band who...
Well, they were another band.
People who were defending Kildren.
But they're kind of too big to get cancelled in this case.
Right. Well,
what were their lyrics again?
They didn't have any lyrics. Well, I think they do have lyrics.
They do have some pretty adverse lyrics on a similar nature.
But they tweeted pretty much the same thing as Kildren have in their lyrics, saying they should be hung, you know.
Right. Okay.
However, they can
do the Lorraine Kelly claim and kind of go, well, actually, this is part of our project and it's an art thing. It's not how we feel and we shouldn't pay tax on it for that reason or whatever. Yeah. However the fuck that went.
It's interesting because, where is the line drawn? Where do you draw it?
I think it has been drawn now, really.
No, but what about if people... Within art, there is irony. On Twitter, there is just text. So Fat White Family say, hang certain members of the Conservative Party, feels even more sincere than lyrics in a song. So should they...
In any other century, imagine what would have happened to David Cameron after what he'd done. Like...
What, with the pig?
No, I'm
not. sorry, carry
on.
You
know what I mean, though? Good one. I mean, the abuse to the Constitution, the constitutional abuse that this country has suffered over the last so many years.
I think if you're going to start doing that and pulling people from Glastonbury and censoring an art form at one of the biggest independent arts festival in the world, then you set a risky precedent, and then there has to be a line drawn somewhere.
If that's the line, then fine. And this is what
I'm
saying.
I don't think it is.
This is what I'm saying by the fact that it's played into the Tories' hands. That's all that's happened. Like getting, you know, risque commentary in songwriting is like to a festival is much like smuggling drugs into a festival. If you get caught out doing it, don't be surprised if you get banned from going. Like, it's just like that, really. It's just crass.
Ultimately, the point is, if this hadn't have had as much publicity as it has, they'd be playing, no question.
Yeah.
And that'd be that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't work. Obviously, it doesn't work the other way. I mean, this is that kind of thing that people complain about. Why are there no right-wing comedians? It's like, because they're not funny. Like... How is that a legitimate business prospect?
Mm. I mean, we
know there are some right wing comedians, but they've been rightly put in the bin.
Yeah, like, you know, yeah, well, from days left, of old. They've been left in the 70s.
Yeah, exactly.
Picking up on attitudes towards lyrics now, do you think it's harder to say things a bit more risque, if you call it, a bit more sensitive now than it maybe was? And I'm going to go back decades from the 60s, 70s, and
80s. It depends what it is.
Do you, and I suppose an open to the floor. So I've looked into sort of lyrics in the 60s, and Jim Morrison appears quite a lot. You know, as a, you know, he was...
Yeah,
gave off the impression that, you know,
very problematic.
It was naughty, wasn't
very
it?
Very problematic.
So could a Jim Morrison lyricist exist now?
No,
exactly. Yeah. So
no
do you,
chance.
Do you think? Yeah. Do you think that? Do you think Kildren in the '60s would still be playing Glastonbury?
Yeah.
Okay. Probably more so.
but it's one thing. It's one thing to compare. Well, I don't know. I don't want to defend what Kildren said, but I mean, wasn't Jim Morrison speaking out of experience in some of those lyrics?
Well, yes.
Okay.
I think he was.
Well, I'm guessing Kildren have never killed any Tories. Well,
okay.
And so, but what Jim Morrison sang about was potentially very disturbing things that had already happened.
And what we shouldn't forget in all this is that pop music, in its widest term, is all about pushing that taboo. That taboo has been pushed to the absolute brink in a visual sense.
Yeah.
All that is left is the oral sense for it to get pushed.
Yeah.
And this has only come out of a place where some people... I'm not saying that some people will share that sentiment of Kildren's, like, literally, but... people are pushed in this country beyond all history, in a political sense, in a domestic political sense. This country's never been quite put in the corner that it's in right now. So, you know, it's uncharted territory for all of us. But it's also, let's just remember that I don't think they want to write that song. Is what I'm saying.
Okay.
I don't think they want to write that song in the way that it has. But for one reason or another, we've allowed things to just get too far. Both in a pop music sense and in a political sense, they've both been pushed a bit too far.
Okay.
And unfortunately, this, like, you know, if Ed Sheeran had actually just released something good, like, maybe we wouldn't be in this place. But we're not in that place, are we? Because he hasn't.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Interesting summation. I wanted to.
bitch.
Yeah. You're right, Dunk.
I don't want to sound boring. I like Taboo, but I just feel that if someone could actually come out with some... if someone of that kind of ilk can, you know, respond, you know, kind of whose actions had a trickle-down effect on the wider listening community, they'd actually just come out with something that had some fucking meat to it, musical meat, lyrical meat, something that's like, you know, a good album, then maybe it would change things a bit.
Do we have to pay royalties on that at all?
I think
how does that work?
I think
there was one
notes.
Note that was different, so we're okay.
Oh, no, I was definitely freestyling.
I'll be out of copyright, let's hope.
So we actually went for some chips this week. We went to Brewski, which is on the main road in Chorlton, just opposite the Morrisons, just opposite the Met Stop. It's relatively new, isn't it? I think it's only a couple of years old.
Well, yeah. But
two,
well,
3 years old.
Well, obviously, we're such old salts of the bar scene around here that we remember the Shack and whatever it was before the Shack.
Yeah.
What was it before the Shack?
Abode, was it? Or was that next door?
Abode was next door, I think.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, they've all been shite.
Yeah. I was pleasantly surprised. First impressions going into Brewski. I thought
Nice beer choice.
Nice beer choice. Expensive beer
choice.
£5.50 a fucking pint.
Yeah,
£5.50
for the session ale as well.
£5.50 a pint.
Do I have to tell people where you live?
what do you mean? in its glory.
I mean, we are in the wank annex, aren't we?
Or the wank wing.
The wank ex. The wank wing.
Okay.
I hope that's been parodied.
That's fair. Still, £5.50 a pint is...
Yeah, £4.90 is all right. £5.50, fucking hell.
Fucking hell. Yeah, but it was great. It was great. So, they do a Canadian specialty of which is called a poutine.
Yes.
Poutine.
A poutine. Is it a poutine?
I think it's poutine.
Okay.
Actually, maybe that would have an A in it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. We'll figure that out.
Poutine.
So,
wow.
Jesus. From the first part of this podcast being unedited, this bit is...
carry on.
No, I'm just sort of Googling what a poutine is. Poutine is a dish that includes French fries, cheese curds topped with a brown gravy.
Or as we know it, chips, cheese and gravy.
Chips, cheese and gravy if you're
from Marple.
If you're from Marple, exactly.
Well, if you're from anywhere around here.
I think from the north in general.
If you're from north, it's chips, cheese and gravy.
So not that I come across as a bit of a tight bastard, but it's £5.50 a dish. And when you're ordering chips, cheese and gravy, is that all right? £5.50 for chips?
But it's not chips, cheese and gravy. It's poutine.
It's poutine, yeah.
Yeah.
Or poutine.
And I mean the first thing we looked at was the poutine platter.
Yes,
that was touching £30. Yeah, it's like fuck.
I wanted to order that to see what it would look like.
Yeah. Like it might be like a mountain. The band account can't really take those kind of moments of indulgence.
Can barely take £5.50.
Band account where Rob's put £25 in to pay for his own merch or something like that. So, okay, so we got the we ordered the number one, which was the original, which is chips, cheese, and gravy, and we ordered the number four, which was the salt and pepper poutine.
Worth noting at this point that we got both of them with veg gravy.
Yes, yeah, with veg gravy. And the number four, we added sesame tofu for an extra £2.50. So that number four dish was £9.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's
now you say that, that does feel expensive.
It does feel expensive.
Do you think? I mean, how much... I don't know. I mean, like the Beagle, for example, in Chorlton do topped fries, don't they? I don't think that's... There's not that much difference price-wise there.
Not for £9.
It's like £7 or £8.
You say there's not that much difference, under £7. Right? You say there's not much difference. Possibly the difference is £1 to £2. However, when you go to a place and you order a burger and your burger's £8 to £9 and then it turns out that chips are an extra pound, you're offended by that, and rightly so. You just assume chips are going to come with this, and it's kind of weird to see chips as a basic kind of as a foundation of all these dishes to kind of be thrown into this, like, you know, it kind of confuses the matter. You're not sure what you're paying for in terms of the extras, because they're all chip based.
They came quick though. They had a little poutine bell.
Oh yeah, the poutine man rings twice.
I've
never seen that film, so I have no idea what I've just referenced, but fuck it.
It's like an alarm goes off, doesn't it? And right, there's my chips already, kind of thing. Which is fine, which is great. And they came, they were piping hot, they were great.
They were all right.
They were delicious.
The first thing we all said was, ooh, it looks like school dinners.
Yeah.
That was the first thing we all thought. Yeah.
If I'm just going to go first with my own critique about it, I think speed is of the essence. I think once the heat of the gravy had disintegrated the curds, it started to form a sort of snot-like...
baby food.
Yeah, a snot-like texture in there, which I wasn't keen on seeing at the end of my fork.
Mm. I like that.
Before that, I thought it was great.
For some reason, I don't know why I was sceptical about the cheese curds at first. But they were great.
Yeah.
That was fantastic. Again, appearances weren't... Because I was more interested in having the number one dish. Because, you know, when we go and do these things, it's a bit like we do like the Trump steak test, don't we? It's like, I want it overdone and I want it with ketchup. Because I want to know just what the chef's thinking when you ask for that. So asking for the number one felt like, well, this is the thing we should really be determining the quality on. Essentially, and it feels like it must be quite a neglected dish like at that place. I imagine they very rarely get asked for the number one.
I don't know.
There's so many add-ons. Like there's so many add-ons there.
I agree.
It's too many things. I just think that they're overlooking perhaps how good the number one could be. Because I kind of did enjoy that more than the tofu five spice one.
I like
at times,
both.
But it just didn't look. It's just its appearance. Yeah. Its appearance didn't look great, but it tasted good. The chips were good. And as I say, the cheese was surprising because when I read cheese curds, I was like,
"What
like,
is that?
Is that like lemon curd?"
Yeah, yeah. What is that?
But it felt basically like balls of grated cheddar, wasn't it?
Maybe we can look into it. But I thought it was. I was really surprised at how it all tasted. I'm a real sucker for things being put on chips as well. You know, so anything.
Well,
you know,
this podcast tries to not put things on chips. Yeah. We try to keep them light, let's just talk about the chip. Yeah, yeah.
I think with that place, because that's the speciality, you know, we had to do it. Because chips is the base ingredient.
Yeah, you couldn't go up to them and go, could I have chips without the gravy or cheese? Because then they'll just go, oh my God, are you chips or Cholton? And be like, yeah, bitch.
No one would say that.
Yeah.
Right. Well, one day they will.
Yeah.
Rob, one day!
What do you think, Rob?
I mean, I quite enjoyed it, to be honest. Like we were saying, it was a bit of a throwback to school dinners, but the chips were decent as well. But maybe, I don't know, maybe there was too much gravy, so it kind of sat, you couldn't have that kind
well,
of...
Well, we were all basically arguing as to whether the gravy was Bisto or not.
The veggie,
and then it made
us
go, well, there's nothing wrong with Bisto gravy because it's all vegan friendly.
Yeah.
And then as you said, Andy, the very nature, well, the very purpose of Bisto gravy is not to be the gravy itself, but to be more of an additive to a more natural gravy you would be making at home.
Mm. Yeah, if it was a meat gravy. But it tastes great.
It's more about gravy than I've ever known before, really. Just finding that little morsel out of information. And two things about that. First of all, I would expect if you were going for the meat gravy, you'd get possibly a better quality one. Secondly, if you're paying nearly £30 for a platter of what is chips, cheese and gravy, you'd expect a pretty good fucking gravy on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry,
true.
Fucking good gravy.
Yeah.
That's how you swear properly.
Fucking good gravy. So maybe I mean, the way I judge the place we go to is that if I would go back to them, and I think I would go back to that, to Brewski, I think I'd probably take the family back.
Same.
No,
yeah.
I think so. I agree.
I find it. I find the everything really good.
I kind of like how standard we all seem by that prospect.
I know. It's like,
I mean, it is Cholton.
So imagine going back to somewhere that's not Peter.
God, I think I might go back there.
I know, yeah. So I've been back to Benito Lounge.
Well, we might go back for the quiz if we finish this up in time.
Yeah. Yeah, quick. But yeah, I thought it was great. So should we do some scores? Are we ready for scores? We done?
I've got a calculator out.
You got the calculator out?
Yeah.
Okay.
The supercomputer.
I don't want to go first because I need to see what you're... I'm going to see what you're doing.
All right, okay. I'll go first. I don't mind. In all honesty, 7.2.
7.2.
Big.
Oh shit, I've typed 2. Sorry. 7.2. Okay.
I mean,
then.
And that's also taking into account kind of, you know, service, the bar itself, atmosphere.
And
chips.
We do that these days.
Yes. And I know we've said school dinner, but there's nothing wrong with school dinner from time to time.
There's nothing wrong with nostalgia.
My only real complaint really was just that the number one didn't look great when it first came out because it's like this should be more of the pride of the place.
Yeah.
So yeah, 7.2. 7.2.
Robin?
I think I'm going to go
7.4. Okay.
As we know, I'm always kind of flirting between 6.9 and 7.5.
We do all know that.
Yeah. But I thought even the, you know, the gravy and five spice on paper sounds like it wouldn't work, and cheese. It did actually work, and all came together, and it was quite a tasty dish.
I'm gonna go lower. I'm gonna go 6.6. Yeah, it's just because I had a bit of a cold. But there was one forkful where I thought, oh man, that looks like snot.
Oh yeah, and I can understand that.
Man, they're the best bits.
Neil,
I'm gonna go 7.9.
Jesus.
Whoa. No, that's too far.
No,
you feel like you want to bring Andy's average up a bit, don't you?
Yeah, it would have been lower.
Not necessarily that, but I honestly... do I think it's the best I've had in this podcast? I don't know. I think it's up there. It's up there for me anyway, so
okay.
7.9 is... I was really impressed. I want to go back and try more. That's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, so, that's a good sign.
Yeah.
Okay, I've inputted it into the supercomputer, and it's 7.3.
Okay. We should really have a league table.
Yeah, we should, because that, otherwise that'll be lost in the ether.
One of us will do that one day.
One of us will do that one day, yeah.
What kind of stupid fucking question's that?
Why is Guy Garvey Scouse now?
I don't know. All, you know what? All of my impressions have gone very skew-iff.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
What kind of stupid practice. Fucking questions? That? I don't know. You know, I have no idea what he sounds like. Anymore.
Yeah, I mean...
Anymore. I don't know.
I think
anymore.
You're getting the gist.
Like,
yeah.
Thanks for those who replied to my Twitter question on what questions do you want for Dutch Uncles. Phil, as usual, did a top five question. Top five rider dips. Do not answer. We could discuss that, and we do have the answer.
I mean, we could give him number one, or should we just leave it?
We can do number one.
Number one is the Morrison's sour cream and chive dip.
That was from the Brudenell as well in Leeds, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Speak for yourself.
Absolutely bang on. Okay, and we got the usual when you're doing another album.
At some point.
At some point, yeah. Okay, the full English breakfast came up. What do you think of the new Dixie refurbishment?
I've not seen this Dixie.
Hey! I noticed this. I noticed it the weekend when I walked past. I was like, whoa!
I was in a band.
I went in there. No. Wait. Right. So I noticed there'd been a refurb over the weekend. I was like, you know what? I think Dixie's upped its game here. And I went to do the quiz at Dulcimer with my quiz team, because even though I am very much in the quiz game, as you all know, it's good to actually still be a quiz patron and actually kind of enjoy someone else's quiz. So I was doing the Dulcimer quiz on Monday, just 2 days ago, and then afterwards it was like, hey, that Dixie's had a refurb. Should we get some veggie burgers or something like that? Because, you know, trying to get off the chicken because... number of reasons. I went in there, I was like, all right, mate, you got any veggie burgers? No, sold out. All right, fuck you then, right? So I don't know.
You can say, oh, five-piece strip meal.
Yeah, all right, fine, 10-piece strip meal.
See you later.
No, so just left, unfortunately, but okay. It looks great in there.
That's the answer.
I'm intrigued. So, yeah. I'm intrigued. But we'll save that. We'll maybe save that for when we...
Looks
yeah.
Good.
Okay.
Whether the chicken's good... whether they've changed the chicken as well, I don't care.
So we got another question on album 6. Really good question on Patreon. I wouldn't mind addressing that as a separate section of the podcast, but that's from a 4A's band. Thanks for that question. I want to talk about that properly, sort of pledge music and things like that. I've sort of folded, so we'll talk about that later. Peter Bates said, would be interested to know how you all keep the wolf from the door in between touring.
I don't know what that means.
I don't know. So considering we haven't toured probably for 2 years now.
How do I keep from wanting to tour?
I don't know.
It's really easy.
It's interesting. Like, he says that. I can recall most of the times I have self-loved on tour.
Okay,
that's so not what it means.
No, okay. I remember the Dusseldorf toilet. I remember.
You can't say these things because we were likely in the room together, and then I might have used these certain facilities after you.
To be fair, dear boy, anyone could have been in the room that time.
Oh, man. Okay,
but there were others, of course. But yeah, I don't know. It's weird.
Fantastic.
For sake.
Absolutely fantastic.
Oh, headline shock story: Duncan wanks in a Dusseldorf toilet.
Moving on. What did you actually think of the Beagle? That was the episode we didn't air in the end, didn't it?
We're going to do it again.
I think we're going to return to it.
Yeah, we'll go back to it.
We're going to give it a second go.
And my wife Eva has asked me your thoughts.
Are you putting your kid to bed?
Yeah, finish up and put Connor to bed. So what are your thoughts on the new pod pad is Eva's question. Thoughts on this room, basically.
It's cold.
It's cold, yeah. I think we have addressed that. But the one that we do want to spend a little bit of time on is from John Ardolino. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. And it's it says, most frustrating song they have, so you have recorded, basically. So what's the most frustrating song you've recorded? Most takes, / issues, / changes.
Yeah, I think we had a couple of them earmarked.
The first one that comes to mind is Fergu from the first album. We recorded the first album like live, and
it was a two-week professional demo. In many ways.
In the best studio we've ever been in.
In the best studio we've ever been in for that opportunity. Studio that since then has got even better. Yeah. And after we went there, a lot of very big names went there. And it was just like, wow, I can't believe so many people are going to this professional demo studio that we went to.
This is Clouds Hill in Hamburg, isn't it? It used to give it a name.
It was amazing. We were there for 2 weeks, but we recorded the album in 4 days and then just got pissed for the rest of the time. We weren't even allowed to ourselves.
No, wait. We didn't just get pissed. We got pissed and played the best ever game of hide and seek you've ever seen.
Yeah. Every night.
Yeah.
I think the hide and seek thing, I think that just gives you a...
The hide and seek, that was great.
Just gives you a sort of idea of the scale of the apartment that we were staying in, though.
I think that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was really good. I've honestly never had a game of hide and seek that good in my life.
Yeah.
Honestly not. I probably never will again.
No, I doubt it.
And I'm happy to leave it at that. If I never play hide and seek again, I'll know I've played the best game of hide and seek.
I remember Pete hid himself in like a chest. Do you know, like a toy chest? He fit himself in there.
He was there for like an hour.
I know.
He really was.
So this is why we recorded the album in 4 days, but had
Fergu,
So
what happened with Fergu?
I think the thing with Fergu is the fact that we recorded the other 9 tracks pretty easily. And it came to that one, and it took many takes.
It was plus 30 takes.
Why? Yeah. Why was that?
And what was more...
Because we were recording to tape.
And what was more...
And we wanted to get it spot on.
Yeah. Well, the idea was is that because those 10... Well, 2 were already recorded, but the other 8 were toured... toured, bloody hell. They were gigged extensively. So
By which you mean maybe a handful of gigs.
Yeah, yeah. But we knew them inside out, and the idea was to get spot on takes of all of them. And Fergu, to be fair, it's probably the most complicated, from maybe my point of view, to play.
Yeah,
it's probably one of the most complicated you've ever made, Rob. True. Yeah. There's a composition, because usually with us, when it comes to any time signature in any of the songs we've done, the song will usually just cut that shit out when it gets to the chorus, and all of a sudden it's a 4-4 chorus.
All of a sudden
it's a 4-4 chorus. That one is actually 11-8 all the way through.
Yeah.
I do have to take exception with the fellow who was engineering it at the time, because I think he did tell us that he'd spent a reasonable amount of money on some new 2-inch tape that he'd put on the machine, and he kept pressing his talkback mic and going, and we're still rolling.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like half an hour through however many takes of Fergu. Yeah.
That was the
pressure. We started to really crap ourselves. I don't think we're ever going to get this.
Yeah, that was the pressure, because we were touching 30 takes on Fergu, knowing that we were wasting all of this 2-inch tape, and we had €4,000 as budget for that album. It was like, Jesus, like, this guy's just losing money left, right, and center. Yeah. Then we found out later that he'd actually made millions in stripping in the tobacco industry.
So it's all fine.
And that in fact we'd recorded most of that album with a Nazi snare drum.
When did you stop playing Fergu live? I can't remember.
I remember the last time we played it.
Yep.
Much like my wanks.
Dusseldorf next to Andy.
Yeah. There was another song, of course, that made this list, and it is from our fourth album, Oh Shudder, and the song is Accelerate.
Yeah.
I refuse to take this any further. You carry on, Andy. You can describe this. You were behind the sound desk for a lot of this.
Yeah. Accelerate started...
I remember the original version of it. I wanted to write something that was in between Paramore and these New Puritans, which probably is Dutch Uncles anyway.
Wow, what a Venn diagram.
Yeah.
But that was the idea, to make some kind of fusion between these two things, and it ended up being something completely different.
I think even when you'd written the original one and it sounded a bit like that, we knew it had something. It had like a chorus to it that we liked.
Yeah.
And then the original sort of demo that we made with the producer, Bren, was more like a Fleetwood Mac cover. But executed really poorly.
I was basically trying to rip off Christy McVie in the whole thing of that. I was trying to do Christy McVie sings Hall & Oates. That's where my lyrics were at for that. And melody.
I remember listening to the demo of that, and I think I prefer the demo version to the record version.
Yeah.
And it's the same for the track off Big Balloon, you know, the kind
A Chameleon.
Of, no, the, well, probably that as well. But the the one that was...
That could be any of them.
I know what you mean. Sync.
Sync, that was it. Yeah. There's like a really, there's a real change.
I would change the guitar riff.
Yeah. Yeah, or just something like, you know, just like, so. Yeah, yeah, so why did you do that?
Well, I mean, the original demo of Accelerate, the Fleetwood Mackey one, I think at the time, I don't know, I'd like to listen back to it actually, but I think at the time, you're always in your own little bubble writing and especially producing, you know, it. And I think it just, at the time, it felt just too cheesy. Mm. Like, Duncan did a good job of writing the lyrics and the tune, but it didn't really stick together that well. And then I can't remember the way it took a turn into the more sort of electronic version, is it?
I think what you're describing here is a moment where I think we very much went, we went very insular at that point. I think we stopped listening to what was going on around us. I think we stopped looking at the realism of our situation, which is good in some ways, but then it's also, it has a negative impact in other ways if you pursue that too far, because it's just not, doesn't work. And yeah, I think we'd come out of that Louis Theroux experience of being on tour with Paramore and just gone, there was a lack of communication happening within the band, which became evident towards the end of the album, of making it.
Yeah.
Which I think is evident to everyone around who was listening and a fan to us at the time. At the same time of that, yeah, it sucked. Basically, like that song was just like, it was just bizarre, because me and you, Rob, as writers, we didn't know what we wanted to do at that point. I think
with that,
we
song,
weren't
like,
quite
I,
sure.
I'd kind of fallen out of love with that song because I remember writing Upsilon a bit after that and kind of having an idea of where that track was going, but this Accelerate was there and it was going to stay. And I think it's just because we put so many hours into it. And I think
the band refused to let it go. And
Brendan's written a thesis about it. Like,
yeah, well, me, he, we need to. I think he got so far in it that at one point he'd actually rewritten the Macarena into it. Yeah. Like, he did. That was like month 16 of working on that song. It's like, hey guys, I think I fixed it. It's like, no, actually, you've just made the Macarena. Do that.
Well, maybe one day someone will hack the stems of that and release them.
Yes.
And then sort of radio.
If they showed you every shell of that song where it started and where it ended, I'd sell that for 18 quid if anyone wants to buy it. I was going to buy it.
Talking about a Chameleon as well, it went through kind of a very indie-ish version, would you say, to start off with?
Hey,
and then
I got a lot of time for that.
It's a very boring version. Yeah,
yeah. And then there was
it was boring.
Well, no. I know what you mean by, I know when you say boring, I think what you mean, I think it was very repetitive for what we'd already done. It kind of seemed like a bit like when Block Party did Flux. It's a bit like, yeah, this is a good song, but you've already kind of gone there.
Yeah,
you've done it better before.
Yeah.
Like, we'd already done that kind of song better before with Festa, was the first example, and then Upsilon as well. So it was going to end up being the third incarnation of that kind of template.
I just want there to be like a lesson at the end of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, what's the lesson? Stick with it, because ultimately, anyone other than us has no idea that all these things have happened, and they judge it off face value. A 3-minute piece of music might only listen to it once, they might love it, they might hate it. Or is the lesson to take the first incarnation, take it at face value yourself, and think, actually, this is shit, and we should bin it completely and start something new?
Yeah.
It's difficult to know what it is. And I don't think there's a right answer in there.
No,
really.
You're right. Yeah.
Well, for me, and I don't want this to sound cynical at all, because it doesn't come from a cynical place remotely, but when we first had a demo of A Chameleon, and it was a full band version, and if I could compare it to anyone, you know, like, just to give anyone an idea of what it would have sounded like as a full band version, it was very much kind of New Order, because there was there was that choir noise that was very much Blue Monday.
Yeah.
And when I first heard that, I was like, finally, I think we've got a song that the Manchester audience might embrace us for, because for me, like, I don't think we've ever really had that. And it kind of stings a little when you're a band from Manchester, but you don't feel like, you know, we support the Cortinas how many times back in the day?
Too many.
And yeah, too many. Like, and we've been on the, you know, we've been on the circumference of seeing all that happen. It's just like, if not that, you know what I mean? Like, you just want to know that where you are at home, people are going to recognize you for that thing at home. Maybe, but then again, we do have that. Like, so I'm not going to feel bad about it, but like, for me, that's what I thought. I thought this could be a song that really connects us with the Manchester audience, if they kind of go, oh yeah, they like Manchester too. They're not just some weird proggy bastards.
Yeah.
All
but
the
it,
time.
But it, well, yeah.
Given the question that we just had, and given the chat we had about the National before, do you think if you had the time to develop and maybe the lack of pressure to put a tune or an album out, would Acumelian have been shelved and saved for a later record when you could have decided what to do with that tune? Because the tune's good. The bare components are good about it. Again, I'm looking at reference to the National. There are songs that they have had in their back catalogue for 6 years, three album sessions, and they've gone, right, we finally nailed this tune. Now it's on the record. Why did you feel the need to put a Chameleon out on Big Bully?
I think there's a lack of precedent of ever doing that, I think. Yeah. Because we've been making music for so long together and we've never done that, then I think it just felt very unnatural.
Also, I think A Chameleon's job as a song in terms of spurring us on to actually get a body of work ready to have an album, it did its work. Like, it inspired a lot of the songs that came from it, because it was only at the very end game of making Big Balloon that it turned into this piano song. So before then, it had been a full band song for a while, and it was, you know, it was in the demo stage, wasn't it? Along with Same Plain Dream, it was as intrinsical to that album as Same Plain Dream. So I think to hold it back for something else would have been disingenuous to where it was at.
It would have felt like it
still fits. Like, I would take other songs out from that album before that one.
Yeah,
you know, I think it deserves its place in that album before.
And I think we've never really looked that far back. When we've started writing a new album,
I tend to, like, you know, when me and you are discussing what could, you know, what comes next or what could happen next, you do look at ideas that you've not, you know, taken further.
The only one I can really think of is Bellio. Like, Bellio was written, the music, the original idea for the music was written probably three or four years before we recorded it.
Okay.
So that's the only example I can think of where we've looked so far back into the catalogue and it's come back, whereas generally we work in a fairly concise period of time. And
what do you think? I suppose the question is, do you think that's, what's the best way to work? Is it to wait until you think you perfect something, or just sort of work in those periods and put things out?
I don't think there's an answer to it.
Yeah, there's no formula. It's like
in the past where I don't know, bands just want to, like, they want to have a fresh approach to things, which is fine. But then sometimes, us included, make these sort of, you know, really far-reaching, sweeping statements about what it's going to be like. We're not going to do this. We're not going to overdub a million times. We're only going to play live. And then you reach a really good song that Rob and Dunk might have written, and you think, actually, we probably shouldn't just play this song live. We should appreciate it in a sort of studio environment. I think we're really guilty of that, just being like, this is what it is. This is what the album is. If it doesn't sort of adhere to that statement, then it can't, you know, be in there. Whereas really, everything is song by song, whatever's best for the song, you know, works.
Yeah, we should be thinking more about the song rather than the press release, basically.
Yeah. Like, they all recorded this.
That's easy for you to say. You'd have to write the press release.